All right, we're back to you live again. This is the Magnus and Marcus podcast. I'm joined with John Marcus, and we're in Eugene, Oregon.
Yes, or technically Springfield at a super top secret, very high level, very delicious cafe. I don't want to give it away because I like this spot. It's pretty low key, but let me tell you, best almond milk mocha in all of the Springfield, Eugene area, right here where we are. So on location, caffeinated, ready to roll.
That's right, and most importantly, no random track people around here.
Oh, that's true.
Which is,
yes,
unusual for this time of year at USA.
Yes.
So, it works.
But talk about keeping a low profile here. I do my best, and as some of you may or may not know, Steve's not trying to do a good job at that right now. But hey, but we're going to talk about other things other than that. So, take it away.
All right. So we thought about, somewhat relatedly, we talk about distractions in life.
Yes.
So distractions from a coaching perspective and distractions from an athlete perspective. So I don't know if you wanted to start, John, and get us rolling.
Yeah, I think, you know, not even just thinking in the terms of sport, but life in general, I think some of the conversations I'm having a lot right now with active athletes and prospective athletes and even just colleagues is about how to deal with the multitude of distractions at different times within a training cycle, at a championship race, you know, even coming off of a less than palatable racing experience as well. So it's something we don't really talk much about in sport and in coaching. You know, it's so much more as the running theme is X's and O's and recipes on training and getting the physicality of someone ready to go. Versus here, it's how do you really buffer? How do you keep simultaneously, you know, 35,000 foot view of things and put it in perspective, but also to put the blinders on and really get laser focused about what really, really matters at this point in time, whether it be a specific stimulus or response you're trying to get in training, or whether it's about being able to get out and compete and just qualify the next round if you're in a championship setting as we are right now at the USATF Championships in Eugene.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. I think it's almost like developing two skill sets, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You have to be aware enough to have a larger view, but focused enough to be like, this is all that matters at this one given point.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you have to do is be able to come in and out of those,
right,
those states. Because I know a lot of the misconceptions coming out of college, for example, is a lot of athletes feel like they have to be this extremely dedicated, type A,
mm-hmm,
everything's on point. I'm always focused on doing everything I need to do to run better.
Right. I call it the once a runner myth. I love one of my favorite books of all time, but it's the once a runner myth that I need to go into the woods with zero distraction, and that's where I need to live, kind of, you know, Thronian style, where I'm going to Walden Pond for 2 years, and I'm going to find out how to live. I think there's some real advantages to that as well, but at the same time too, it shows a certain temperament and also a certain degree of maturity to be able to live in the middle of the city and find that enlightenment or that sense of purpose. I mean, in Buddhism, one of the main things they say is like, if you have to go to a mountain to meditate and find enlightenment and you can't do it in the middle of the marketplace, it's not true enlightenment. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about true alignment where, in spite of all the comings and goings and stressors and curveballs that are thrown at you at, you know, a given day in your life as a human being or at a race, given the conditions, or if you're delaying the start or someone trips and falls, how do you deal with it in the moment? So being hyper process oriented.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's building resiliency,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
It's if you're in the woods and all you have to do is run.
Yeah.
It's rather simple to go run.
Yes.
It's like when I always give the example, when I was in high school and all I had to do in the summers was go run 100 miles a week and sit around the rest of the day and watch movies and be not productive.
Right.
It was really easy to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But did it shape me in a way to withstand resilient points? I don't think it did.
Yeah.
Because I was used to this, you know, this is all I'm going to do, this focused approach. And
yeah,
what it does is it creates you, it gets you good at that one circumstance. But once you're in the real world outside of that, it all, you know what, hits the fan, I think.
Yeah, and this is kind of, again, herd mentality par for a course on herd mentality. I mean, if the Kenyans and Ethiopians, who are arguably the best, most competitive, you know, nations at distance, middle distance running in the world right now, if they're doing this, which is going to some training camp in Eton, and, you know, there's all they're doing is looking at the wall in between runs, eating, sleeping, washing clothes, and they're really fast and good, well, you know, ergo, we need to do the same thing here. Versus, that's not always the case. For might be advantageous for some athletes for stints of time, but I know other athletes who, when they put the whole heart and soul and everything 24/7 is about running, they were depressed and miserable and the running wasn't going well. I mean, Phoebe Wright, good friend of ours, to give her a shout out, you know, she's now in graduate school, and all of a sudden, she has this extra thing to do to kind of, like, provide some structure to her day, or, hey, I got a priority outside of my running and training, which is important, but not all-consuming, and that gives her the balance to actually have this kind of resiliency in her career as she's experiencing this season. You know, Tara Ergman, another example. She, you know, full-time professional runner, you know, was on a contract, but she was like, man, I just can't do this every single day, and actually took up being a part-time real estate agent just to get out and meet new people and be challenged and do something a little bit different. And I think a lot of people honestly are like that, because if you just put everything into it, when it's going great, awesome. Like, you know, you're excited, you're running well, great. But then as soon as you have a bad race or a bad workout or a little injury or a little cold starts to happen, it magnifies the, you know, adversity of it to such a degree that you kind of lose perspective that, hey, it's just a little sniffle. I'll be okay if I miss this workout and do it tomorrow. Or, hey, it's just a little, you know, tightness in my calf. I'll get some therapy, take a couple days off, and here I go. Instead of, like, my whole world's crumbling down, what am I going
to
do?
Well, it's because when you do that, you tie your entire self-identity to it.
Exactly.
And it becomes an attack on who you are and what
yes.
you are. Right, and I think one of the differences is it's really easy to fall into that trap of
yeah.
that the East Africans do this, so we should do this.
Right.
But there's very distinct cultural differences
yes.
between them
mm-hmm.
and between, you know, Western societies. It's their society allows or affords them to live lifestyles like that. If you grow up in most American major cities, you're in an ADD type lifestyle, right? You have this going on and this, and from the age of, you know, 6 years old, you had school, then after school you had this practice, and then this lesson, and this practice, and then after that you were on the internet, and then you did this, and there's always a distraction there. Okay, we're not very good at having this kind of, well, we're not very good at the art of doing nothing.
Yes, agree. Yeah.
The art of doing nothing for us is a stressor.
Yes.
Okay, if we sat around and had nothing to do all day, it would be a stress.
Well, and plus, from a society standpoint, something's wrong with you. If
yes.
you're not, if you're not doing something, if you're not being a productive, you know, worker bee, what are you doing? Why aren't you going out there and getting this done or getting that done? I mean, you know, so I think we have to be cognizant of that and actually pay homage to it, rather than try to bat up against it. Be like, well, again, we just need to keep up with the Joneses. The fastest people do this, so we need to do this as well. And as we've talked about many times on this pod, that is not the best prescription 99.99% of the time.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And that's why I think it's, you know, the way I see it is there's productive distractions and negative distractions.
Yes.
And it's not about minimizing, you know, the distractions in your life. It's seeing what ones will add to growth
right.
and what ones won't.
Right.
And that's what it's all about.
Yeah, I think that growth mindset is critical. I mean, right now, you know, I'm reading or finishing reading Players First by John Calipari, just about
yeah.
his whole coaching philosophy and the Kentucky, you know, basketball culture, the whole one and done culture. And, you know, he, by putting these players first, really creates this family atmosphere or this kind of stepping stone culture for a lot of these soon-to-be NBA stars. And granted, they're only around for maybe, you know, 8 to 12 months before they go off into the big leagues. But he's saying he's able to use that to the advantage, being like, look, you guys are Kentucky, you guys have a high national profile, there's going to be a lot more eyes on you, but don't let it be a distraction. It's still just the game of basketball. We're still trying to get you better and prepare you for this next step. And the other book, too, to kind of balance it out, is like Rumsfeld's Rules. And despite what you think of Donald Rumsfeld's politics, you know, he essentially has created a magnum opus of just a lot of different guiding thoughts and trajectories and quotes up along the way that he picked up through his, you know, decades in service. And I mean, talk about distractions. It's like, you know, he talks about the network different presidents or even politicians create to minimize those distractions. So by the time, you know, certain items or certain questions get up to that high level, they've been vetted and vetted again multiple times. So the president only has to make a quick decision here, a quick decision there, because he has all the information there already pre-established, so he can make that with authority, but also with some swiftness, rather than sit here and debate for, you know, weeks, months on ends, because there's a lot of decisions to be made at that level. And the trickle-down effect is it's the same thing within your own practice and your own life, is, you know, having a lot of information there to be able to make the choice, is this something worth stressing about right now? Can I really control this? Like the weather, for example, is always one of the biggest stressors at track meets, yeah, especially in championship. The weather seems to impact and dictate 90% of how people are going to compete. Not the other people in the race, but the only thing I always hear about is there a headwind? Is it hot? Is it cold? Oh, well, we can't do this now. It's too hot. We can't. It's like, well, and yet it always seems a little inverse logic to me. We go in the middle distance running culture to the best tracks in the most predictable weather areas possible in the nation to run time trials right there where it's all laid out, but yet we always go to these really adverse conditions in championships, whether it's down south and you have thunderstorms and humidity, or whether it's out west in the summer and it's really hot, or, you know, out east where it can fluctuate between being, you know, negative degrees this and then all of a sudden 100 degrees that. So yet one of the most critical fundamental components of preparation becomes this distraction to then freak out about rather than to use to your advantage on race day. Sometimes it's like, I also tell athletes when you start freaking out about the weather, it's too windy or hot. Hey, everyone has to deal with it. Every single person has to deal with it. You're not special. You know, like, everyone has to deal with this condition. And that's a valuable thing to remember sometimes, is to get out of your silo about you and your world. Understand, like, some distractions aren't really distractions. Everyone has to put up with it.
Yeah.
So it's being able to create a thought pattern where you can, like, put it into that bucket. This is not a distraction. It's just a condition everyone has to deal with. This might be a potential distraction that could really derail me. So how do I cut this off or end this really quickly so I can focus on business as usual? And that's, as Steve and I were talking about offline before we got on the pod, you know, it's kind of the job of the coach to really be able to help teach an athlete and a team how to do that, because we were saying before, coaching is just pattern recognition, but all the time. Good coaches are recognizing patterns and processes all the time, whether you're making saddles, buying groceries, you know, seeing how your dog reacts,
yep,
you know, when you guys go on for your routine walk or when you change up that routine. I think the good coaches are always looking for that and processing that to just further and more quickly recognize patterns, so that then when you see it here with an athlete or a team, someone you know really, really well, you can then really address it swiftly and quickly, just like the president. I have all the information ahead of me. Hey, this is worth freaking out about, but you know what? We're gonna do this to prepare you for this. Okay, great, now you don't have that as a distraction. Or hey, this isn't worth freaking out about. Forget it, let's just go do this, you know?
Exactly, I think that's why the longer time you spend coaching an athlete, it leads to independence, because you become extremely adapted at recognizing patterns within that athlete or within that group.
Yeah.
Where you can say, all right, well, this is this, we're going to go do this now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on that point, I think it's a good thing you brought up Rumsfeld's kind of thoughts, which I've skimmed through too, is that we have this tendency to blow things up. The more and longer we think about it,
yes,
we blow it up. It's just human nature. You know, I was reading a good book, which I'm going to go blank on right now. I'll put it in the notes. But it was talking about, you know, conscious versus non-conscious decisions.
Yeah.
And one of the coolest studies they took at is they looked at if a person, an individual, could predict their behavior better than a stranger could predict their behavior. Okay, stranger never met them, right? And they found out that the strangers could predict behaviors to certain common reactions much better than the individual would.
Yeah.
And the reason was it because the individual had all this information, all this whole narrative of who they were in their head running through it. And that the stranger just saw, oh, X, Y, and Z. This is how normal people react to that. This is what he's going to do.
Right.
And that was it. That was the only information. I think as coaches, like, that is key sometimes.
Yes.
Don't blow things up into bigger than they are. If it's hot out, whatever. Can't control it. Right? Yeah. If this person's in your race, whatever. Yeah. Can't control it. Mm-hmm. All I can do is myself, you know? I was down at Gain, so Vern Gambetta's kind of clinic coaching madness last week, and someone brought up the Jamaican sprinters and whatever on your individual thoughts on them, but his point was he went down and watched them train, and they were on a dirt track.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Right? Uh-huh. And he asked, how long's the track? And they're like, we think maybe 300 meters.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, what? Yeah. And you know, they were said on their intervals, it wasn't how much distance. It was like, oh, you start over there. You start over this curve. They didn't know exactly.
Yeah.
Right? The weight room was shoddy. And when he asked the coach, why don't you guys get a new weight room? It's like, well, we could. You know, such and such shoe companies would allow it. But I don't really want it.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, we've kind of... training in Houston, a lot of people are like, the heat, humidity, but we look at it as just the way people train at altitude. It's a thing to make us physiologically a little tougher, but also able to handle anything, because we go anywhere, it's going to be nicer weather than we've dealt with.
Or when it's adverse, like we were at the NCAA West Regional Meet in Austin, Texas, I talked to Steve, I said, man, you guys just must be pigs in mud right now. He goes, yep. Doesn't bother our guys. We're used to this, you know, humidity and thunderstorm and this type of stuff. Versus someone coming from Portland, I mean, I had to, you know, prepare the 10K woman that I had down there for a month doing heat acclimatization training. And here's this poor girl in all of May wearing full sweatsuits, gloves, hats, you know, nicest part of spring in Portland. And I'm like, yeah, sorry, you got to do this. I mean, it ended up working out significantly in her favor. I mean, I told her the benefit would be worth the cost. Of the sacrifice, but you know, we had to prep to do that versus you guys were able to embrace it and just be able to allow it to make you stronger regardless of whatever happens.
Exactly. And I think that's a huge point. I mean, not to make it all about our program, but our track is horrible.
Right. Yeah.
They're finally redoing it next year, but it's got holes in it the entire way around, and you actually run on spots where you're running on the, you know, asphalt underneath that.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So it's probably the worst track I've ever trained on.
Yeah.
But we train on it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, you know, at first, whenever you get guys in, they're like, oh, this track sucks, and after a while, they just adapt and like, well, this is what we got. We're gonna use it. And it doesn't really matter.
Right.
Like
it's not a distraction.
Yeah, it's just, it's 400 meters around, and we know that, and who cares? And it's about, I think what it is about is, it's about framing things in the right way to grow from.
Exactly. And you and I are sympathetic on that, because at Portland State, we don't have a track. We share with a high school, you know, and there's little kids who run around from the Montessori Elementary School. PE classes just come out on the track randomly during reps. Intervals, and we have to yell track so we don't collide them, or we go to another public use track. I mean, we're very migratory, and again, same thing like the Jamaicans. Our weight room is very shoddy. Whenever I like bring someone over, I'm like, hey, welcome to, you know, Rocky 5 weight room. Like, we're just getting it done. No lights, you know, no new technology. Everything, every bar in here is at least 20 years old. I mean, and contrasting that with the you know, proliferation of having all these accoutrements to athletic success, 5 Alter Gs, underwater treadmill, the newest, you know, weight room platforms, and, you know, videos to record your bar speed. I mean, which are all really valuable data sets that you could use, but at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. It matters that you have what you really need to get done. You need a track, you need some weights, you know, you got trails, it's good. I remind that of actually when I do recruit at Portland State, like the Jamaicans train on grass and dirt tracks. The Kenyans train on a dirt track. The Ethiopians until recently trained on dirt tracks. So some of the most powerful nations and most competent nations in track and field don't even have the synthetics to use it. But when they go to a Diamond League meet, when they go to a world meet, they're just thankful to be practicing or competing on something that's 10 times better than what they practice on. And there's that gratitude towards it versus, someone, you know, to kind of take a really quick tangent this way, you know, we have post-collegiate runners who went to Power 5 schools, and they have all these, you know, types of material things. And I, you know, one of the models I started to develop with a lot of the post-collegiate recruiting I do is you want Power 5 talent, but with a mid-major mindset. Because you get out of that, you know, little, you know, incubator of the Power 5 schools, and now you're trying to train for the Olympics or train for world teams, and now you have to be very migratory. You know, most situations you get to, you don't have a track. You're using a public track. You know, it's, hey, everyone's living in a different part of the city in my training group, but then we meet two, three times a week to do this together, and I'm on my own for, you know, when I do my easy runs. There's no practice time is this time. We're all meeting, and we're all doing this. We're all going to training table, or, oh, I have, like, the athletic trainer right there at my disposal. Should I get a hangnail? Like, you got to book your own massage. Like, you got to be a lot more autonomous and a lot more independent in order to thrive post-collegiately in our track and field, middle distance, distance world. And a lot of people who come from those Power 5 schools, they don't recognize it's actually kind of a strike against you because you've been so catered to. I mean, which is something you should be thankful for, which is a great, great thing, but doesn't really set you up to embrace the struggles, you know, post-collegially. Now, it's not something to be distracted by. Like, oh, man, well, okay, I only want to do this or do that. It's like, use it to your advantage. Frame it better so anything that might be a distraction becomes an advantage. I think the best coaches and athletes do that consistently.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, again, to get back to gain a little bit is not to belabor the point, but one of the things that almost every good coach there, which many world-class coaches doing stuff from football to U.S. skiing to everything to international, you know, Premier League soccer teams, is they were like, the theme was take what you have and just use it to your advantage. It's not about having, like, you know, these devices to measure bar speed, you know, or this newfangled machine, or even a standard weight room. It's saying, what do I have to use to my advantage? And I'm going to create the training around this dynamic and take advantage of it. You know, and it's like you said. I mean, I remember the first time I was in grad school and went over to Europe with my good friend Moses Joseph, who was a two-time Olympian.
Yeah.
And we were over there in Belgium, and we were, you know, training on a circular track, right? And for our strength stuff, we were just finding some random stuff to pick up and, you know, do some stuff with. And, you know, just making it up as you go. Uh-huh. And it was very contrary. You know, when we were in Virginia, we had our kind of set stuff, but we said, oh, we'll make this work.
Right.
You know, and the same thing when I, you know, a year or two after Alan Webb ran 3:46, I remember, you know, meandering onto a high school track, trying to, you know, hide our way onto a high school track to work out. And I remember PE coming out in the middle of it. And, you know, here's a 3:46 miler doing intervals, you know, in between people. And you know, it sounds ridiculous, but those are the those are the things that, like, you grow from.
Right.
Like, this isn't, you know, to put things in perspective, I think it's just track and field, as we've said so many times. It's just track.
It's not life or death. We're not trying to find cures to cancer. You know, this is, I was talking to a mentor coach of mine the other day. He goes, sport is actually a very bourgeoisie activity. I mean, it's an activity of kind of the upper class. Hey, we have so much free time now. We have all our, you know, necessities met. Let's have these contests to see who can do this really arbitrary, unique, you know, activity for this duration of length or for this duration of attempts the best. And then let's then create, you know, a hero myth based on who can do these feats of strength the best. I mean, really, putting it in perspective and understanding, if you're not, and that's one thing I always ask every athlete that I, you know, potentially work with is, what have you learned from this sport? What have you learned from your previous coach? What's the one thing you were taught that you didn't know before? And because sometimes, like, you get these athletes, these wounded warriors who come to you and be like, oh, well, this coach was awful for me, and yeah, he didn't do this, she didn't do that, oh man, no, she's awful. It's like, no, they're a good coach because they've coached a multitude of people, and I've, you know, seen great results from them, talked to them, they know what you're doing. You had to learn something. And then you start to tether out, oh, well, I did learn this about tempo runs. Or, oh, I did learn about strength conditioning. Oh, I did learn about iron supplementation. Oh, I did learn about mental visualization and preparation. See, they're not all bad.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, it's just like any relationship. There always becomes an end date. One of the, you know, most respected coaches that I've ever, you know, that I admire is actually Larry Bird. When he was with the Indiana Pacers in the early 2000s, he said, hey, I'm going to do this for 3 years and then we'll be done. Regardless if it's the best team in the NBA or worst team in the NBA.
Yeah.
And he stuck to it because he put an end date on that relationship. And I think that helped spur at that time that Indiana Pacers team of a Jalen Rose, a aging Reggie Miller, it said, well, we only have the legend, Larry Bird, coaching us for 3 years. Let's make the most of it. Versus you got these kind of open-ended contracts of, hey, I'm just going to coach you until, or run for you until I don't feel like it anymore, it doesn't happen. And then that slowly turns things south. Like, an athlete-coach relationship is not a marriage. You know, that marriage is, that's with one person, one time only type deal, you know, and that's it. Sometimes, yes, present company included, you are fortunate enough to coach your spouse, but it's like, at the end of the day, I always tell my wife, like, if you're unhappy with me as a coach, just, I'd rather you move on to another coach, and we're still married, and I'll be fine with that, rather than have our athlete-coach relationship infect our marriage. You know, and I think that's smart. I always, now I tell athletes, hey, it's a 2-year contract, just verbal contract between us working together in the post-collegiate world, because if after 2 years you're not thriving, it's not that I'm the bad coach or a bad athlete. Something's not working, and life's too short, your career's too short, to stay somewhere where, yeah, you may respect me and love me and think I'm the greatest guy in the world, but in 2 years, if it's not working out, it's time to move on because, you know, for whatever reason, it's not getting the job done. And that's ultimately, you know, ideally why we're here, is to make that happen. So, you know, I kind of going back off that tangent a little bit and kind of piggybacking what Steve said earlier, you know, about trying to prepare everything and micromanage everything and have everything be perfect, I'm a big fan of actually Seth Godin, who is a big fan of saying, just ship, just ship. You've got to ship it. Because when you start shipping it, that's when you start finding what the errors are or finding that people are foggy or unclear about it. So get your product out there and ship it. It might not be the perfect product, but you don't get through the perfect product on the first attempt. It's about the 10th, 11th, 12th draft that product's perfect. I mean, Steve knows from making a book, the first time he wrote, you know, his book, his editor came back to him and just probably gutted him and said, this needs to go. You need to have this.
You're exactly right. I mean, not to get on that tangent, but the first copy of my book sucked. It sucked. I mean, even the first couple I shipped, because there were some errors in what copy they got mixed up. So the first, you know, probably 100 or so that shipped had editing errors in it.
Yeah.
And I was like, that happened because I'd never been through that process. And yeah, it sucks, but you know what? Fixed it, corrected it, and it's now I know. And that's what it's about. It's not like, oh man, we screwed up. It's, oh man, I never would have figured out that X, Y, and Z mattered and this could occur unless I just said, okay, let's go for it and go and we'll figure it out. And that's, you know, that's one of the biggest things, whether in coaching or life or jobs, is you're gonna screw up.
Oh, screw up all the time.
You just, and that's the thing, is you take your ego out of it and you realize, all right, I'm gonna screw up, but this is opportunity for me to figure out why I screwed up and how to do it better.
Right. Yeah, fail fast. That's what I always say. You want to fail quickly, figure out why you failed, you know, have that summation happen as quick as you can, so then you don't fail via that, you know, channel again, you know. But just because you failed here doesn't mean you're not going to fail somewhere else. And that's the beauty of coaching and teaching and learning, is you never stop failing. Like, if sometimes we go through academia and you want the 100% on every test, and you see those A-type athletes, especially in this classic setting where, okay, just tell me exactly what to do, you know, so I can check it off every day. I'll check off the workouts, check off the mileage, and then you go to race day and it's like, hey, this is an artistic performance. You have to figure out, based on the fluidity of what other people are doing and the conditions of the racing environment, how to perform, and they just totally freak out and they can't get it done and they're just deer in headlights.
And you know, that's a good point, because it's like, you know, for instance, yesterday, but going into this weekend, is I never really give my athletes a play-by-play, you know, direction on this is your race strategy. It's a global approach of like, well, you're prepared for this, you know, feel it out.
Yeah.
See what happens. Right. Like, this is the general plan, but you know what? Stuff's gonna happen.
Yeah.
You're gonna have to figure out how to respond to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there's a problem when you give, as a coach, when you say, all right, this first, you know, this lap's this right. is this, I want you to do this at this point. At this point, I want you to surge and do this right. no matter what.
Right.
It's that's not coaching.
Yeah, well, at least not at our level. Yeah, I mean, at this kind of post-collegiate adult level, even kind of college, you know, older college level, no. Like, for you middle school and high school coaches out there, that definitely, I think, is your role, is to say, hey, in a 1500, you don't want to get out too hard.
Right.
You know, you want to make sure you have a lot left in the tank to be competitive in the last 800. And I believe, you know, fundamentally with, in those early stages, you do need to be a little bit more prescriptive with your approach. Now, we're talking about an athlete who's been doing this for 10 years, 15 years, and you still have to hold their hand like that with a play-by-play, you know, race plan. Something's wrong. That's a systemic failure somewhere down the road.
And again, I think that's a great point, is it's going from dependence to independence.
Yes.
When you're young, yes, you have to give more prescriptive, you know, data on how to execute a plan, because they don't have the experience. But as those experiences grow, that leash is lengthened, and you just kind of keep lengthening until it's almost independent.